This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, written by Catherine Clinton, read by Shayna Small. For John Hope Franklin. Preface. Remembering Harriet Tubman. 100 years ago, in the small upstate New York town of Auburn, a charity home named after anti-slavery martyr John Brown was planned. The modest two-story brick structure was not remarkable in any other way, except that it would fulfill a lifelong dream of the ex-slave who had settled there in the decade before the Civil War, Harriet Tubman. Certainly, she would have preferred that in the new 20th century, her rising and flourishing nation might provide for the aged and indigent, the orphaned and disabled, of whatever color. But while so much had changed since she was born into bondage in Maryland in 1825, Harriet Tubman knew how America had also stayed the same. There would always be those in need, and even as she approached the age of 80, Tubman continued to extend a helping hand. She would never give up the struggle for racial justice. If she could not fulfill her dream of establishing the home, which all blacks deserved, then she would die trying. After first striking out for freedom as a young enslaved woman in 1849, Tubman returned south again and again to help scores of slaves escape with the help of the Underground Railroad. When the Civil War broke out, the struggle went above ground, and Tubman was an active participant in the fight to defeat the Confederacy. Once the rebels finally surrendered, however, Tubman knew the fight was not over. She had given so much to her country, but she knew it would be a continuing battle for blacks to be granted rights associated with genuine freedom. And as a woman, Tubman recognized that the struggle for women's rights would be an even harder road ahead. In 1865, Tubman returned to her adopted home, Auburn, New York, which had sheltered and protected her and her extended family since before the war. She wanted to carry on her campaigns for justice within this community and decided to maintain an informal shelter in the house she had bought from a patron, Secretary of State William Seward. Over time, she was able to expand her horizons and purchased an even larger parcel of land in hopes of establishing a separate charity institution. With the help of her church, this dream was eventually realized. In 1908, the Harriet Tubman home was dedicated. 5 years later, Harriet Tubman was dead. Harriet Tubman had been a liberator, a woman who stood up to the slave power, and a warrior whose actions spoke louder than words. Unlike most women born into slavery, she seized the road to freedom, not just for herself, but also for her family and others during her decade-long association with the Underground Railroad. This bravery earned her a fierce contemporary reputation. She was on the slaveholders' most wanted list, with reportedly a steep price on her head. Posters with the description of Moses, as she was called, were prominently plastered throughout the Upper South until the Civil War broke out. During the war, in addition to nursing soldiers and assisting slave refugees in the coastal South, she took on a military role, organizing scouts and spies. Tubman led rescue missions to free slaves deep into occupied South Carolina. Her notoriety, her association with the infamous John Brown, her utter defiance of nearly every stereotype associated with those held in bondage, made her an anomaly. But the way in which she is remembered clearly has its own complexities, its own history as well. Harriet Tubman became a celebrity during her years with the Underground Railroad and was an acknowledged war hero for the small circle who followed her Union career. Yet the larger public rarely gained insight into her character or her motives, as she became in some ways a symbol rather than a flesh and blood figure by the end of the 19th century. At the turn of the 20th century, there were occasional articles and tributes published on this remarkable woman, but by the time of her death in 1913, only those who had been directly associated with Tubman kept her memory alive. In recent years, Americans have enjoyed a renewed appreciation of the champions of black freedom. Frederick Douglass is the subject of multiple biographers, and a lucrative historical book prize is named in his honor. The accomplishments of Martin Luther King Jr. are celebrated on a national holiday and analyzed in a continuing flood of scholarly and popular imprints. Sojourner Truth, Marian Anderson, Zora Neale Hurston, and even Rosa Parks have all commanded scholarly biographical attention, while Harriet Tubman has languished. One authorized biography appeared more than 100 years ago, and another was written by a journalist born in her adopted hometown of Auburn, New York. After multiple rejections, his manuscript was finally published by a black press in 1943. For the most part, the life of Harriet Tubman has been confined to the storybook world of Following the Drinking Gourd and Freedom Quilts. These accounts are more folkloric than analytical, more riddled with inaccuracies than concerned with historical facts. Much like Sally Hemings before her, Harriet Tubman has been subjected to more fictional treatments than serious historical examinations, a reflection not of her place in the American past, but of a failing on the part of the Academy. This absence of scholarship must be recognized as a form of disremembering. While Tubman was alive in the imaginations of schoolchildren and within popular and underground culture, she was a mystery to professional historians, who consistently mentioned her but failed even to set the record straight about her role and contributions. Over the past half century, there has been a renewed interest in the life experience of slaves, as well as a flood of literature concerning the way in which slavery shaped our American past. Concurrently, scholarship in women's history has blossomed. Within these twin literary revivals, the lives of women slaves have emerged, and the experiences of fugitive and runaway slaves have been tentatively and creatively mapped. Scholarship on the world within slave cabins and those behind the scenes of the Underground Railroad has always been handicapped by the lack of traditional documentation. But scholars in the 21st century have persisted, recreating with ingenuity and imagination the lives of those denied literacy and of those forced to carry on clandestine struggles. Major historical prizes have been awarded to scholars who have created histories of those who did not leave behind diaries and letters. Underground history is gaining ground, as oral history and other methods of recovering lost experiences have proved fruitful. Scholars within and outside the academy are by necessity becoming more adventurous, recognizing there is a world outside the archives which requires our attention as well. During the research for this book, I found 21st century scholarship and family lore from descendants as useful as the conflicting published accounts of the 19th century. I have tried not to privilege one set of sources over another and to weigh competing accounts, rival agendas. Tubman's character and accomplishments dwarf efforts to try to capture her between two covers, but she remains a figure whose determination can push those of us who work on her to probe even harder to try to tap into the core. Harriet Tubman maintained an unblemished record of vigilance, creating a legacy of sacrifice and struggle that carried into the 20th century. She never grandstanded on any particular issue and made all her public pleas for the benefit of others. Tubman inspired those who took up similar causes during the civil rights movement and feminist revivals of the 1960s, but had a broad humanitarian bent, which is perhaps why she has become a figure with such universal appeal. Yet she cannot remain a mammy figure, a warm, nurturing historical caricature. As with Pocahontas before her, Tubman's life demands more than pop culture projections and forces us to seek the underlying causes that make her legacy so powerful today. Though Harriet Tubman became an icon during the last years of the 20th century, with this book I hope she might become human as well. We may never fully recapture the past, but we can take on some of the struggles of those who came before, in the name of those who will come after, and in this way, truly remember Harriet Tubman. Chapter 1. Born into Bondage. At the turn of the 19th century, the eastern shore of Maryland was in many ways a world apart. The rich, rolling field semicircling Chesapeake Bay, abutting Delaware to the east and grazing Pennsylvania to the north. Fields, dappled with sun and lush with grain, were crisscrossed by dozens of waterways throughout the peninsula, joining rivers flowing from marshes out to the beckoning salt water. Waterfowl and wildlife were abundant, offering hunters as rich a harvest as that gathered by those who cultivated the land. The Eastern Shore was separated from its sister slave counties by the oyster beds that spread underneath the water to Maryland's other western shore, where the bustling ports of Annapolis and Baltimore dominated the regional economy. Beaver traders originally populated the Eastern Shore, but by the 1660s, the pelt trade was depleted and planters began to settle the region. Commercial rather than domestic agriculture flourished, as tobacco farms dominated at first. By the 1750s, fields of tobacco were replaced by fields of corn, as planters found it less labor-intensive and more profitable to plant food for export to the West Indies. Philadelphia merchants moved south along Indian trails, scouting for grain, finding eager suppliers along the Chulptank River. In early America, the planters who settled the marshes of the Eastern Shore, the African Americans who struggled within the bonds of slavery there, and the clusters of emancipated blacks who formed pockets of liberty within the countryside created a complex tangle of competing agendas. Black and white, slave and free, acquisitive and hard scrabble crowded together within this narrow strip of Maryland. This was the world into which Harriet Tubman was born and came of age, a time and place gnarled by slavery's contradictions. She was born near Bucktown in Dorchester County, Maryland, to parents who named her Araminta and cared for her deeply. Yet because she was born a slave, the exact year of her birth remains unknown, unrecorded in an owner's ledger, lost even to the parents and child themselves. Most accounts offer her birth year as 1820, 1822, or circa 1820, roughly 200 years after the first boatload of Africans was sold off a Dutch slave ship in 1619 at Jamestown, Virginia. Circa, affixed before a birth year, is one of the most common legacies of slavery. Like sources of the Nile, the antebellum black leader Samuel R. Ward confessed, "My ancestry, I am free to admit, is rather difficult of tracing." Harriet believed that she was born in 1825, and testified to this fact on more than one occasion. When she died, her death certificate indicated her birth year was 1815. Her gravestone listed her year of birth at 1820. Whatever the year affixed, details of the earliest years of Araminta Ross are equally obscure. And so is her place of birth. Educated guesses place her mother at several different locations during the period 1815 to 1825, but the Brodus plantation near Bucktown, Maryland, is most likely her place of birth, and is certainly where she spent her earliest years with her mother. Family lore claimed she was one of 11 children, but no family Bible with names inscribed survived, and family records present conflicting accounts about the names and the number of Tubman's brothers and sisters. There was no firm evidence of Araminta's place in the birth order. However, she later recalled that she was left in charge of both a baby and another younger brother while her mother went to cook up in the big house. Tubman also indicated that she had older siblings, so clearly she was born somewhere in the middle of a string of children, perhaps nearly a dozen. She might have arrived near the end, as her mother was in her 40s when she was born. Araminta was born to Harriet Green and Benjamin Ross, a slave couple who spent a good deal of their married life in close proximity to one another. They struggled, like most enslaved spouses, to create conditions that would allow them to live together, or at least near each other. They negotiated with their owners, and they had different owners throughout their time in slavery, to create a more stable family life. With each new child, hope might spring anew for slave parents, and Tubman was no exception. She recalled that her cradle was carved from a gum tree, most likely by her father, who was a skilled woodsman. She remembered being the center of attention when young white women from the big house visited the slave cabins. They playfully tossed her in the air when she was just a toddler. These two hazy memories, the cradle and being tossed in the air, are Tubman's only recorded recollections from her youngest years. Harriet confessed that during her youth, she was described as being one of those Ashantis. While she may have had ancestors from Ghana who were of Ashanti lineage, there is no evidence for this. Perhaps it was the Ashanti proverbs that Harriet picked up as a young girl. Don't test the depth of a river with both feet, that led her to these claims. All her grandparents might have been African-born, but we know the origins of only one. Tubman's mother's mother arrived on a slave ship from Africa, was bought by an Eastern Shore family named Patterson, and was given the name Modesty. She gave birth to a daughter named Harriet, who was called Rit by her family, and Ritia in Patterson records, sometime before 1790. In one biographical article published the year before Tubman died, the author alleged that her mother, Rit, was the daughter of a white man, but there is no mention of this in any other records or in family lore. In 1791, Harriet Green was listed as property in the will of Athol Patterson. I give and bequeath to my granddaughter, Mary Patterson, one Negro girl named Ritia, and her increase until she and they arrive to 45 years of age. This language was standard in 19th century wills, and indicated that Ritia was to be given her freedom at 45, as would any of her issue born while she was a slave. If Harriet Green had been the daughter of a white man, even of Patterson himself, this would explain why she was given this special dispensation. It was not an uncommon practice among Chesapeake planters to make a provision for the emancipation of illegitimate mixed-race offspring. Mary Patterson inherited Ritia in 1797, and 3 years later, she married planter Joseph Brodus. It was also not uncommon for the father of an illegitimate mixed-race daughter to give the slave daughter to his legitimate white daughter, much as Sally Hemings was brought to the Thomas Jefferson household by his new wife Martha as part of her dowry. Half-sisters commonly lived under the same roof as mistress and slave. Whatever their relationship, Rit accompanied her mistress to a new household after Mary wed Joseph Brodus on March 19, 1800. Brodus and his brothers inherited a 400-acre plot of land only 6 miles east of Chesapeake Bay, known as Eccleston's Regulation Rectified. This land had come to their father to settle a debt in 1792. The nearest settlement was Bucktown. Even less is known about Tubman's father, Benjamin Ross. Nearly all accounts suggest he was a full-blooded Negro, which may have been to contrast his bloodline with that of his wife. His owner indicated he was born in 1795, which would have made him years younger than his wife. However, this was Ben's age as calculated by a master who inherited him. As Ben was also entitled to his freedom at the age of 45, his master may not have been scrupulous about Ben's year of birth. Postponing emancipation meant maintaining added income from the labor of a skilled slave. As slaves, Tubman's mother and father were forced to do a master's bidding, their child's fate determined by their chattel status. Araminta was doubtless provided little more than the bare necessities of life. Planters doled out a minimum of food to keep slave offspring alive. Clothing for these children was scanty and inadequate. One former slave recalled, "The clothes that I wore did not amount to much, just a one-piece dress or gown. In shape, this was more like a gunny sack, with a hole cut in the bottom for me to stick my head through, and the corners cut out for armholes. We never wore underclothes, not even in the winter. We never had more than one at a time, and when they had to be washed, we went naked until they had dried." To an owner, a slave child was purely a commodity, one whose labor could be bartered, whose sole purpose was his own gain. The clarity of this fact overwhelms any effort to give Araminta a childhood. Slavery's ferocious foothold in British North America began in the Chesapeake region, where Araminta spent her entire youth. By the first decades of the 17th century, when attempts at permanent settlement of European colonies commenced, land was bounteous, but labor was scarce. The English in North America welcomed and eventually institutionalized human bondage, fueling a boom in the African slave trade. By the time of the American Revolution, slavery was as much a part of Maryland as the tobacco planted in its soil and the oysters harvested from its muddy shores. Although they were shifting into grain agriculture by 1800, slaveholders on the Eastern Shore owned an average 11 slaves apiece. The children of the earliest Africans in the North American colonies were not always born into bondage. Some blacks came as sailors and explorers. Others came as indentured laborers, later granted their freedom. A few of these went on to own slaves themselves, but free blacks continued in the minority, and over time, racial boundaries became more rather than less rigid. Even after the prolonged battle for independence, when cries for liberty rang throughout the countryside, opportunities for both emancipation and free blacks diminished. Whites assumed the innate inferiority of those with darker skin and imposed their prejudices through custom and law. For example, Maryland slave law took a dramatic turn in 1712 when the colonial legislators adopted a new measure. The status of a child would follow the status of its mother, partus sequitur ventrum. This statute overturned centuries of patriarchal tradition and law. This radical shift was in response to sex across the color line, most especially white males coupling with slave women. As the number of persons of color with white ancestry began to grow, the exponential growth of a mixed-race population presented a threat to the white hierarchy. The 1712 law allowed white men to pursue their appetites and maintain the status quo, while white women were hemmed in by increasingly rigid prohibitions and restrictions on their behavior. A white man who fathered a slave child could mask his illicit sexual connection. A white woman risked not just ostracism, but exile or worse if she was discovered in any sexual connection with a black. By law, any child born to her would be born free. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who was born in 1818 on a plantation on Maryland's eastern shore, near present-day Easton, less than 30 miles from Harriet Tubman's own place of birth, never knew the name of his father. Speculation points to a white slaveholder, perhaps his mother's master, but the details of his lineage remain unconfirmed. By the close of the 18th century, the invention of the cotton gin, 1793, fueled a stampede of slaveholders further south and west. Fortunes could be made planting cotton once an easier, inexpensive way of processing the crop was developed. Settlers began pouring into the new states of Kentucky and Tennessee, where Revolutionary War veterans cashed in on land grants. Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and eventually Louisiana lured thousands onto their rich soils with the promise of extravagant fortunes, all to be made in the wake of slavery's widening sphere. By 1808, the external slave trade was prohibited due to constitutional mandate. After almost 200 years of imports, cutting off the supply of slaves from Africa and the Caribbean had a profound impact on slavery in the United States, with especially drastic results for slaves in the Upper South, where Tubman and her family lived. The domestic slave trade became crucial to slaveholders eager to settle the southwestern frontier. Suddenly, enslaved African-American women, already expected to perform harsh and exacting physical labor, became the sole legal source of slave labor. Deep South politicians were in a frenzy to see their plantation economy thrive and to keep slavery booming. Cotton was not a cash crop in Maryland, but its plantations produced one of the most invaluable crops for the southern antebellum market, slaves. The children of slaves quickly became a vital commodity and source of income for cash-poor planters of the Chesapeake, and of increasing significance to the prosperity of the Lower South. When the international slave trade ended, the enslaved population in America was not quite 2 million. Less than 50 years later, with the outbreak of the Civil War, slaves in the American South numbered nearly 3.5 million. This was an astonishing growth rate, given the high mortality among slaves, especially infant mortality. Slave babies commonly succumbed to any number of childhood diseases that plagued all newborns in the South, but that visited the slave cabins with depressing regularity. The mortality rate for black children in the Chesapeake during the first half of the 19th century was double that of white infants. While enslaved mothers were in the plantation fields picking throughout September and October, infant mortality spiked. Further, many slave mothers had to contend with their own ill health during the winter season, when congestive diseases might fell both mother and child. These illnesses proved more often fatal for infants and young children. The southern climate also meant that blacks, and especially slave children, endured exposure to malaria, cholera, smallpox, and a range of fevers, including the deadly yellow jacket, yellow fever. In the antebellum South, any outbreak or epidemic, with the exception of malaria, hit African Americans in much higher numbers than whites. Despite these health and medical statistics, the increase in the slave population was explosive. By comparison, while the black female birth rate skyrocketed during the half-century leading up to the Civil War, the white female birth rate in the country was declining and reduced by half by century's end. During the same period, approximately 10% of adolescent slaves in the Upper South were sold by owners. Another 10% were sold off in their 20s. Slave parents lived in abject terror of separation from their children. This fear, perhaps more than any other aspect of the institution, revealed the deeply dehumanizing horror of slavery. All over Maryland, slaves dreaded the Georgia traders, the appellation given to any slave buyers who appeared. By the 1820s, Maryland newspapers were filled with advertisements seeking slaves for sale. Sometimes as many as 200 were sought at a time. The Eastern Shore was a prime place to seek slaves to funnel into the Deep South, and there were approximately 5,000 slaves in Dorchester County between 1810 and 1830. Tubman was deeply aggrieved by the disappearance of siblings carried off by the slave coffle. She had watched two of her sisters carried off weeping and lamenting. Tubman was permanently affected by this episode as she witnessed the agonized expression on their faces. No record of her sisters' fate has ever been uncovered, and even their names are a source of confusion. White records suggest these daughters were called Lena and Soph. A family tree constructed by one of Ben and Ritt's descendants identifies them as Harriet and Mary Lou, while a later version by another descendant called them Catherine and Marie. Whatever the names of these lost sisters, these women were sold away, stolen from their families, and never reunited with parents, siblings, or children. Those left behind suffered more than just mourning. Family members lost to slave sales were worse than dead, as there was no peace or closure. Fugitive slave Lewis Hayden painfully recalled, "I have one child buried in Kentucky, and that grave is pleasant to think of. I have got another that is sold nobody knows where, and that I never can bear to think of." Slaveholders treated slave children as commodities and as a means of anchoring adult slaves on the plantation. Owners believed parenthood reduced the rate of runaways. Thus, Southern masters actively promoted pair bonding and childbearing, even though the integrity of these families was constantly threatened by sales. The rates of miscarriage were much higher for African American women than for white women, and better care and feeding during pregnancy was the exception rather than the rule for enslaved women. These were the family values shaped by slavery in the decades leading up to the Civil War. Nonetheless, the pregnancy of slave women interfered with women's productive roles as slaves. Indeed, one Maryland slaveholder advertised one of his chattels as "young Negro wench with a male child 2 years old. She can wash and iron." But he added with some disdain, "she is sold for no fault but for being pregnant." Planter records indicate that supervisors of female slaves were often suspicious of their claims of impending childbirth. Owners, physicians, and overseers regularly accused female laborers of pretending to be pregnant. The charge of shamming was a self-serving lament as much as a legitimate concern, as it was rare for pregnant women to be given any dispensation. Some supervisors did lighten the workload of expectant women in the advanced stages of pregnancy to reduce the chances of miscarriage. Thus, slave childbearing provoked a host of contradictions for plantation society. During the crucial first months of a slave child's life, little was done by owners to combat infant mortality. Few slaveholders reduced the hours for nursing mothers. Fanny Kimball, married to one of the largest slave owners in Georgia, indignantly reported in 1838 that her husband sent women back into the fields only 3 weeks after their confinements. While Kimball condemned his regimens as brutal, his Sea Island neighbors viewed her husband as a model and indulgent slaveholder. She described the plight of a mother who lost a newborn to snake bite. Her nursing infant was bitten while lying in a field where the mother toiled nearby, but not near enough to save her child. In 1801, Tubman's mother's master, Joseph Brodus, died. He left behind his widow, Mary, and their infant son, Edward, who presumably would inherit the 5 slaves in the household. In 1803, Mary remarried widower Anthony Thompson, and Harriet Green, once again, came with the marriage. Mary Brodus's new husband owned Ben Ross, which is presumably how Harriet Green met her husband. Upon Mary's premature death in 1810, the 9-year-old Edward's legal guardian and stepfather, Anthony Thompson, looked after the boy's interests. During this period, Harriet and Ben were able to live together as man and wife and start a family. By 1820, Thompson owned nearly 40 slaves. But Edward Brodus broke up the Ross family by starting his own. In 1824, now 23 years old, Edward Brodus married Elizabeth Ann Keene, and the couple moved into the home his stepfather had helped him build on his late father's land near Bucktown, less than 10 miles away. Harriet Ross and her children went with them, while Ben most likely was forced to remain behind. By 1840, Brodus headed a household that consisted of his wife and 2 sons. His slaves included Rit and 8 children, 1 boy under 5, 2 boys between 10 and 24, 1 older male, 2 girls under 10, and 2 girls 10 to 24. Harriet was one of these females. Brodus expanded his holdings by buying 13 acres, a part of Taylor's Delight, on the road from Bucktown to Little Blackwater Bridge in September 1834. Except for census data, a marriage license, and abstracts from land records, Edward Brodus left very little to offer us clues to his life as a Maryland planter. In 1852, his will was burned in a fire that destroyed the Dorchester County Courthouse, and its provisions were reconstructed in 1854. Ironically, more information about his role as a slave owner comes from Black sources. According to Harriet Tubman's brother, their mother, Rit, was able to keep her family together when a slave sale threatened to rob her of a child. Rit became alarmed after seeing her master take money from a Georgia man named Scott. Hearing the master then summon one of her sons, Rit appeared unexpectedly in the room. Brodus attempted to distract her by ordering her to bring him a pitcher of water. After returning to her work, she overheard Brodus call for the boy again, this time to harness a horse. She immediately returned to Brodus's side. Tupman's brother, Henry, witnessed Brodus's exasperation with his mother and his complaint, "What did you come for? I hollered for the boy." Harriet's mother then accused Brodus of wanting her son for that ripping out an oath Georgia man. Unwilling to resort to force, Brodus was stymied when Rit kept her son hidden in the woods and with friends for over a month. This prolonged period of subterfuge testifies to the complex strategies and networks of slave resistance, which extended throughout the Eastern Shore. It also suggests that relations between master and slave might have been less rigid, more negotiable than they were in the Deep South. Seemingly more annoyed than infuriated, Brodus finally found a servant who knew where the boy was hidden and tried to enlist him to set a trap. When this ploy failed, Brodus went to Rit's cabin to demand the boy, but she threatened, "The first man that comes into my house, I will split his head open." Harriet Ross must have been both a valuable and a formidable woman to stand up to her master and protect her child with such ferocity. In this case, her tactics succeeded. Such family lore, too, would have provided Tubman with a powerful example of the possibilities for resistance. Tubman's brother Henry reported that finally Scott gave up and returned to Georgia. At the end of the standoff, when Rit's son returned home, Brodus said he was exceedingly glad she hit the boy so that he couldn't sell him. Henry's account raises many questions about the complex negotiations between owners and slaves. Was Brodus himself torn up over the prospect of sale and sincere in his expression of gratitude over Rit's measures to prevent it? Or was he trying to placate her? The cat and mouse game lasted for over a month, suggesting the persistence of either the Georgia buyer or the ambivalence of the Maryland seller. When Rit stood up to Brodus in this case, was it because she had already lost children to sales and would not allow another to be taken? This and other family lore make it clear that Harriet's parents fought to keep their family together. Henry grimly confided that Brodus pledged that if Rit would remain faithful, presumably meaning obedient, he would leave us all to be free. Despite such promises, Harriet's brother recalled, at his death, he left us all to be slaves. Chapter 2. Coming of Age in the Land of Egypt. At what point would any child born into bondage come of age and be made aware of her status? 4? 5? How quickly would she discover that the larger world designated some people free and some slaves? What about the color line? When would the difference become crystalline and its consequences devastating? Most slave children in the antebellum era learned the twin maxims of slavery by harsh experience. Their labor was not their own, and they could be deprived of kin. Although African Americans toiling in the field might be seen as the quintessential image of slavery, the more potent symbol of the system was the auction block. Josiah Henson, a fugitive slave who published his memoir, bitterly recalled, "My brothers and sisters were bid off one by one, while my mother, holding my hand, looked on in agony and grief." Henson was also sold apart from his mother. In this way, slaves were forced to confront their utter powerlessness, soul by soul, as one scholar had characterized it. Children were particularly vulnerable to the devastation wrought by the selling off of siblings. More than any other insult, this would have sharpened their sense of the fragility of their existence. Tubman experienced the loss of at least 2 siblings to the slave coffle. One older sister was forced to leave her 2 children behind. How could grieving parents explain this loss? Ben and Rit withstood these tragedies by maintaining their faith in God, by seeking comfort in biblical wisdom. While enduring such sorrows, they could only hope for a better world beyond the land of Egypt, where all their brethren suffered the scourge of slavery. Slave children had every stage of childhood cut short, from nursing onward. They were propelled into adulthood by slaveholders' impatience. Many were sent to the fields as human scarecrows as soon as they were able to walk. In an account of Tubman's life written by her later patron and friend, Sarah Bradford, her childhood is presented as a series of tough seasonings. From the earliest age, her sense of the world was defined by the displacement whites imposed, as much as by any loving circle forged by parents and siblings. In interviews she gave in her later life, Tubman indicated the treatment she experienced during her formative years. "I grew up like a neglected weed, ignorant of liberty, having no experience of it." Araminta's birthplace was one county over from the headquarters of a notorious crime ring, the Cannon Gang. The Cannons had been accused of kidnapping free blacks and selling them in Virginia as early as 1815. A decade later, by the time Harriet was born, the gang had become so notorious that Mayor Watson of Philadelphia targeted them as public enemies. Investigators were sent to find the route along which abducted blacks were shipped south, a mirror image of the later Underground Railroad lines. Authorities discovered that men and women had been chained up at several Cannon properties prior to transportation to the auction block. The gang's activities might have continued unabated had it not been for a tenant farmer on Cannon land who in the first week of April 1829 stumbled upon a buried box of human bones. After the discovery, a circus atmosphere prevailed as people came from miles around to watch as authorities excavated Cannon land, searching for more bodies. The only gang member who didn't flee, 60-year-old Patty Cannon, was indicted on 3 counts of murder, including the strangling of a black child. Cannon died in her jail cell before going to trial. Many children grow up with fears of boogeymen, but young Araminta lived only a short distance from the Cannons' real-life house of horrors, where children disappeared, skeletons were dug up, and slavery's evils were confirmed in the headlines. After years of gruesome rumors on the grapevine, Tubman came of age at the heart of a crossroad where abolitionists, kidnappers, slave catchers, and fugitives hid out from one another. No matter how hard they tried, Araminta's parents were unable to protect her from the harsh realities of bondage. When Araminta was only 5 years old, a woman in the neighborhood, a Miss Susan, drove up to her master's plantation and requested a young girl to take care of a baby. Araminta was sent off without a moment's hesitation, an all too common fate for young enslaved females. Tubman recalled in later years that this new home was the first place where she had seen white people eat and that she was ashamed to eat before them. She was plagued by the strange, uncomfortable newness of a white household. She also was bitterly homesick, like the boy on the Suwannee River, no place like my old cabin home. In her new surroundings, she slept on the floor and would cry herself to sleep. Araminta longed to be back in her own cabin, where she might crawl into her mother's bed at night. She was far too young to take on the responsibilities she was assigned. She remembered being so small that she had to sit on the floor to safely hold the white baby in her lap. Once installed in a new master's household, she was given a full load of domestic tasks, as well as caring for the infant. After a long day of doing her mistress's bidding, the 5-year-old Araminta remained on duty at night, instructed to rock the cradle constantly to prevent the baby from disturbing the master or mistress. If the baby wailed, this mistress did not go to comfort her child, but instead lifted her hand to grab a small whip from its shelf to punish her slave attendant for negligence. One day, Tubman recalled, she was whipped 5 times before breakfast, and her neck bore the scars from this incident for the rest of her life. When her wails awoke the mistress's sister, a Miss Emily, she was given a brief reprieve as Emily tried to offer assistance rather than punishment, tutoring rather than harshness. Even though this kind woman interceded on her behalf, Araminta remained unable to please her mistress and was run ragged in the process. The young girl was returned to her family severely debilitated, weak, and undernourished. Rit nursed her daughter back to health, only to have her sent away again as soon as she recovered. This became part of a pattern. During childhood, Araminta was hired out year after year, serving a variety of masters as a household worker. Tubman recalled an episode that provoked her to run away when she was only 7 years old. My mistress got into a great quarrel with her husband. She had an awful temper, and she would scold and storm and call him all kinds of names. Now, you know, I never had anything good, no sweet, no sugar, and that sugar right by me did look so nice, and my mistress's back was turned to me while she was fighting with her husband, so I just put my fingers in the sugar bowl to take one lump, and maybe she heard me before she turned and saw me. The next minute she had the raw hide down. I gave one jump out of the door. The young Araminta knew what the consequences would be for swiping sugar and fled from the yard. She stopped only when she was too tired to go on. Exhausted and frightened, she tumbled inside the fence of a large pig pen, and there I stayed from Friday until the next Tuesday, fighting with those little pigs for the potato peelings and other scraps that came down in the trough. It became more and more difficult to fight off the mother sow. Finally, Araminta was so starved that she went back to her mistress, regardless of what awaited. During one of the times when she was a slave for hire, put out again for victuals and clothes, as she called it, she was required to break flax. Scutching flax was heavy, onerous work, hardly suitable for an adolescent, much less a child. Once when sent to work in the home of James Cook, she was forced to wade in water up to her waist, fetching muskrats from traps. On one of these wading expeditions, she was ill with the measles, and upon returning to the house, collapsed. Incapacitated by illness, again Araminta was sent home, too sick to work, and worthless to the master who had hired her. She described herself during this period of severe neglect. My hair had never been combed and it stood out like a bushel basket. There are few descriptions of Araminta when she was a girl, except for white observations that she was sickly. Was she bright and talkative? Was she shy and introspective, curious, stubborn? Was she scrawny as a child, or sturdy? Did she enjoy playing with whittled dolls, or was she happier wandering in the woods? Or would she ever have had the luxury of time to herself? Slavery may or may not have robbed this child of traits and preferences, but the absence of historical accounts offers little on which to speculate. In one account of her childhood, Tubman confessed that one of her mistresses would whip her almost every day, first thing in the morning. So when she was in this woman's household, Araminta got into the habit of putting on all the thick clothes she could to protect herself. When the punishment was administered, she would wail, as if the blows had full effect. In the afternoon, When she was out from under her mistress's watchful eyes, she would take off her wrappings. Another account described an occasion when Tubman was being punished for an infraction. She bit her master's knee, and her show of temper meant she was left alone in future by this master. From an early age, Tubman was clever and resourceful, able to provide herself some protection from slaveholders' wrath. By the age of 12, Araminta had graduated from domestic labor. By then, she so resented the close company and smothering supervision of white women that she was considered unsuitable as a domestic servant. She became more valuable in fields, where she could hoe and harvest, more contented alongside her fellow African Americans. The once weak young girl grew into a strong adolescent, of whom much was expected, and much was delivered. As an adolescent, Araminta was farmed out to a man who subjected her to back-breaking drudgery, hoisting barrels of flour into carts. Because it was outdoor work, and she was often in the company of a brother, she learned to prefer, if not enjoy, physical exertion. In the wide open spaces of the woods and fields, she came into her own. She developed awesome stamina. By this time, she always wore her hair pulled back tightly, or wrapped in a bandana or head covering. She learned to love the land, where flora and wildlife reflected seasonal change. The skunk cabbage would bloom in early spring, sometimes as early as February. Whippoorwills would serenade on summer evenings, and during autumn, Canada geese might squawk overhead while migrating south. Winter would slow down outdoor activities on farms as a general hibernation set in, but the seasonal buzz of activities would begin anew each year. Growing from a girl into a young woman, Araminta experienced an intensification of her Christian faith, a deep and abiding spiritual foundation that remained with her throughout her life. Perhaps because she had been so gravely ill during her youth, her mother must have spent as much time as possible by her daughter's sickbed and naturally filled her head full of Bible stories. Araminta was never taught to read or write. All of this religious lore would have been absorbed from chapters and verses spoken to her by her parents, who were also illiterate. Tubman would later complain of her owner's lack of Christianity, which suggests that he was not a church-going man. His lapse in faith, or lack of faith, meant he likely did not provide for the religious instruction of his slaves, nor allow preachers to attend to their spiritual needs. Dorchester County supported a variety of churches, but there are no indications that Araminta attended any of these local houses of worship. If she had, as a slave, she would have been segregated into a Negro's pew. She would not have been permitted to attend an independent black congregation. By early adolescence, she would have learned that slaves' religious practices were a preoccupation for slave owners. Masters demanded complete control of every aspect of slaves' lives. Worship for blacks in the region, especially slaves, was strictly supervised. Slaves could congregate for religious services only with white approval and under white surveillance. In this way, religious instruction emphasized a doctrine of obedience. Slaveholders restricted expressions of faith and maintained an iron rule, especially in rural settings. The Ross family was well acquainted with Samuel Green, a local free black Methodist preacher. Green had the same last name as Araminta's mother, but no family connection has been established. Green may nevertheless have had a strong influence on Araminta as she was growing up. She maintained such a strong and abiding Christian faith that her early years may have been marked by contact with local black preachers and deacons. Their example, if not their tutelage, shaped her during these formative years. The black church in the plantation South was not characterized by buildings. Indeed, any slave congregations felt themselves secret and subversive. Regardless of slaveholders' repressive regime, slaves' religion was key to black culture in the first half of the 19th century, so much so that one scholar had labeled it the invisible institution.
On a deserted road in Dorchester County, a small wooden structure, once a store, can still be found.
The building has a porch and ceilings too low for anyone over 6 feet to stand upright. At the small crossroads of Bucktown, Maryland, only the asphalt and telegraph lines, plus an occasional passing car, suggest it is a later century than Tubman's.
A sense of the past haunts this secluded spot.
Even on a bright day, the place has an air of melancholy. When Araminta was an adolescent, she was hired out to work on the harvest for a man named Barrett. When another slave, a male co-worker, left the fields and headed toward Bucktown, the overseer followed. Araminta raced ahead to warn her fellow field hand, knowing there would be trouble. The confrontation between white and black took place at this crossroads in a small village store. The overseer was determined to punish the field hand who had deserted his post with a whipping. In the confusion of the confrontation, the frightened slave bolted from the store. As the slave made haste, Araminta reportedly blocked the angry overseer's path of pursuit by standing in the doorway, just as he picked up a lead weight from the counter and threw it at the escapee. The weight hit Araminta in the head and delivered a stunning blow. The overseer was accountable for neither his temper nor his bad aim. Araminta's wound was deep and severe. She later recalled that she had been wearing a covering on her head, and when the weight struck her, it broke my skull and cut a piece of that shawl clean off and drove it into my head. They carried me to the house all bleeding and fainting. I had no bed, no place to lie down on at all, and they laid me on the seat of the loom, and I stayed there all that day and the next. Araminta's condition was so grave that she was sent back to her owner, Brodus, with a report that she was not worth a sixpence. Her parents feared she might never recover. In the following weeks, she would slip into a lethargic sleep from which it was almost impossible to awaken her. These spells would come over her without warning. Her family could do little for her but pray, as she lay in her sickbed for months on end. Brodus tried to sell her. Luckily for the Ross family, he could find no takers. When Araminta was recovered, she was hired out to a local entrepreneur named John Stewart, who had employed others of her family, including her father, for many years. Stewart had only one free black working on his lands in 1820, suggesting his involvement in agriculture was minimal. But over the decades, he built up a thriving lumber business, clearing tracts along the eastern shore and selling his product to cities nearby. A canal connecting prime sites was dug sometime during the 1830s. Stewart's canal enabled him to transport his vast lumber shipments by water. By 1840, in addition to his five sons and four daughters, his household supported four slaves and two free blacks. Stewart invited both Araminta and her brothers to join their father in working on his burgeoning lumber operation. She regained her strength and became even stronger during her time working under Stewart's supervision. Soon after she arrived on Stewart's lands, she began to chop logs and tote timber. Her daily haul was roughly half a cord of wood, a sturdy amount that few men could match. She seemed to flourish, unbowed by the reversals she had been dealt. By this time, she had grown to her full adult height of 5 feet. Araminta's father managed the shipping of Stewart's timber to the Baltimore market. The relationship between Ben Ross and John Stewart was a relatively enlightened one, considering the constraints of slavery and race relations in the region. Ben's daughter was extremely industrious and earned more than what she was required to hand over to her owner. During 1 year while working for Stewart, Araminta was able to save enough money to buy a pair of steers. This liberal arrangement between a slave for hire and her employer demonstrated that Stewart used incentive to motivate his workforce. Frederick Douglass wrote in his autobiography that his mother was hired out to a slave master named Stewart. Douglass reported he was not a bad master, though neither Douglass nor Tubman subscribed.